Unjun to war-torn Congo, where he spends a year and a half pursuing a career in journalism. Today, ahead of the first democratic elections in 40 years, a tense encounter compels Unjun to redouble his efforts to find work as a journalist. The reader is Riz Ahmed.
At home, José and Nana were preoccupied with paying the electricity bill and the rent. Trouble had begun about a week earlier when, overnight, the Congolese currency had inflated by 5%. The opposition Debu, an outspoken political movement headquartered in Victoire, leaked information that President Kabila was printing thousands of bills to fund his election campaign. The street's economy was paralyzed. The gentrified part of Kinshasa, the Ville, hardly noticed. The dollar prices at its expat restaurants barely budged. But our neighborhood was in turmoil. There was a rampage of purchases, and the extra cash accelerated the inflation. Nana constantly needed money. By the time the frenzy cooled, I had bought several crates of water and toilet paper. Nana had bought so much rice, the storeroom resembled a small granary. José advised I keep my money somewhere else. He said, not to scare unnecessarily, but I don't want you to have a bad experience in my house. The next day, I combined some errands with a trip to the bank to open an account and make the initial deposit. It was a relaxed day, and after an interview with an NGO boss, I was waiting for a taxi. Then, without warning, the road filled with honks. A 4x4 with blinking taillights roared past, followed by a convoy of black jeeps. It was the president. But tailing him, almost harassing his convoy, was a rattling car drawing a long opposition banner. People were being called to march against Kabila. Demonstrators would soon block the traffic. I would have to hurry to the bank and hurry again to reach home. I waved my finger vigorously. A white hatchback stopped. The driver leaned out. "Boulevard?" he asked. The two passengers in the back seat squeezed me between them. The driver wore a felt bowler hat. The car was in good shape. The seats were clean, our feet rested on rubber mats, and the dashboard dials seemed to work. The travelers smiled at me, as if they wanted to make friends. "You like our country?" the driver asked. "Very much," I said. The driver smiled, looking at me in the rearview mirror. We passed a wide grey building. "Look at how the army lives in that hospital," he said. A decapitated tank covered in ferns sat in the courtyard. "It's been this way for a long time," the driver said mournfully. "Congo could be the greatest country in the world if they shared just a little of our wealth, but our leaders only think about themselves. Egoists." It was a familiar grievance in Kinshasa. I didn't feel qualified to speak. Our car sped through the streets. In the boulevard, we came upon an orange edifice, the Ministry of Migration. Now the driver completely lost his head. "I used to work there, but they threw me out. It is the Ministry of Malice. They should make it a prison. No need to move anyone." The other passengers laughed. An urge overtook me. I wanted to show I cared, even though I was a stranger. "That ministry stole $200 from me at the airport," I said. "Even though I had a valid visa from New York, they threatened to lock me up until I paid a bribe. That place is full of thieves." The driver stopped nodding and he frowned in the mirror, the edges of his face now contorted. "Thieves," he murmured, so softly that he seemed to whisper, and then his tone was frighteningly hysterical. "Thieves! You are who to be talking like this?" We suddenly accelerated. When the car swerved off the boulevard, I realized I was in trouble. "I'll get off here, please," I said. "Calm down." The driver pushed me back with a firm hand. The backseat men pinned down my shoulders. The man to my left plunged his hand into his trousers. He fumbled with a black revolver whose handle was misshapen. Deftly, he ejected the magazine. It was full, stacked with shiny bronze bullets. He reloaded the gun, cocked it with a click, and pressed the barrel against my temple. I screamed. He pressed his fingernails into my throat. "Shut up or I'll shoot." I felt disconnected from the world. I squirmed as I felt their hands move up the insides of my legs and down the small of my back, over the lining of my underwear. Their rough hands, sandy, coarse. I gave in, only wanting them to stop. They dumped me near the river, in a wealthy neighborhood. I fell on the ground and rolled to the side. The hatchback, speeding away, didn't have a license plate. And I'd lost the money. Thinking the cash would be unsafe in the house, I had taken nearly all of it. And now it was gone. It was early morning when I called Mosi, the journalist. I had not told Nana or José, and even to Mosi the words did not come out. $2,650. I decided to press on with my journalism plans. I needed money. There was no time to dally now. In the internet cafe, I went through the news. There were a handful of stories about Congo, and nearly all from the big four agencies, the Associated Press, AFP, Reuters, and the BBC, written by the same four reporters. I leaned back. Mosi squinted at my flickering monitor. "That one writes for a British newspaper," he said. "Who, Bentley? You know him?" Mosi had his number. Bentley said he might have time if I came at once. The taxi dropped me at the Grand Hotel. The air inside was icy. A chandelier glittered on the ceiling. The hotel seemed something like an oasis in the city. I explored the halls in a stupor and arrived at the outdoor cafe where Bentley had asked me to meet him. The correspondent wore a white shirt, brilliant in the bright light. He carried a notebook and two large telephones in the palm of his hand. He offered me a beer, and almost as soon as we took our seats, I was jealous. He lived at the hotel. He hardly had to move to find his sources. He had air conditioning. He surely slept well. "Do you know anyone who might buy my work?" I asked hopefully. Bentley frowned as though thinking. I asked for advice, but he would not extend any. I felt small. I made to leave, and it was perhaps this silent expression of defeat that prompted Bentley, as he glanced at his watch, to relax and drop his guard. "Why don't you try the Associated Press? Their correspondent recently quit." I froze. Had he really said that? Back at Victoire, in the internet cafe, I sent the agency a message. Almost immediately I received a call. It was the bureau chief. He hardly let me speak before launching into an onslaught of questions. "Yes, yes, of course we need someone, but who are you? And why the hell are you in Kinshasa?" I became the agency's stringer. Without official contract or salary, or even proof that I worked for the press. But the editor had agreed to look at my stories. I could perhaps earn enough to live. Most crucially, I could for the moment stay in Congo. Almost immediately I ran a string of stories for the agency. I had never written a news story before, but my acquiring the job coincided with a spate of Congolese air crashes. I became proficient at reporting such deaths, identifying the type of near-antique aircraft, the often illegal cargo, the usually drunk Ukrainian pilots, and the number of unfortunate passengers. I progressed to other kinds of news, which stunned me for appearing in 100 newspapers across the world. It was a thrill not only to see my name printed, but also to feel that Congo was suddenly getting more press. One story I wrote was about a moving army battalion that had contaminated 20 villages with cholera. Another was about Congolese soldiers kidnapped by Rwandan fighters hiding in the forest. I received my first payment. It was a happy moment of sorts. I collected $340 from a neighborhood Western Union. I got home and paid Nana my share of the rent. She said at once that it would not be enough. José was still making nothing, and the family would soon be broke. I was becoming attached to the family and feeling tangled with their fate. In the shade of my room, but sweating, I listened to the bulletins. The headline one afternoon was of women protesting abuse. Gathered before a UN base, they had scuffled with the guards and tried to get in. 400 rapes and the UN hasn't acted, I told the editor. One woman says she was raped by 6 policemen, but no one was questioned. Hundreds of women had protested, I explained. There had been a spate of human rights violations in Kananga. Where? The editor asked. Kananga. It's near the middle of Congo. Was there any shooting? No. Any fighting, clashes? No. Any violence at all? Not that I know of. So no dead. Correct. He paused. Nah, not interesting. From the outside, as a reader, the world of news had seemed orderly, confident, authoritative. But on the inside, I felt disoriented, lost. I could not understand why none of the following excerpts from my notebooks qualified as world news. Laurent Nkunda, dissident general, raided Eastern Village. Huts pillaged and burned. Some 80 people fled. 3 elderly found dead. City of Butembo plunged into great psychosis, according to the mayor. Population is patrolling the city to combat would-be vampire. Death, as a rule, had the best chance of making the news. And in a country torn by war, one might imagine such news would be abundant. But in Congo, so many people died that, farcically, mere death was not enough. I needed many deaths at once, or an extraordinary death. Then a sensation broke in Liberia. Charles Taylor was caught at the Nigerian border trying to flee, and it became impossible to sell Congo. The agency didn't take a story for more than a week. I heard 3 miners died digging a tunnel, and then a rebel group was planning an attack. But after 10 days of my incessant calling with such news, the editor laid it out to me. I wasn't to phone unless it was serious. We're busy, he said, and I don't have time to explain why we're not taking this. The editors had their own hassles. The bureau in Dakar covered 22 countries, and every day was a grind, a competition to beat the other agencies, to edit and translate from patchy language, to identify what would be important to customers, for the agency, primarily Americans. Think about what my grandmother in Wisconsin would want to read, an editor told me. There were 3 in Dakar, toiling in front of computer screens, and the constant news of rape, death, child soldiers, it must all have blurred. Lying in my bed, I took copious notes, trying to make sense of the bulletins for myself and for the outsider. My notebooks filled up. I would become overwhelmed and pace around the room, unable but to imagine the scenes. They made me numb. The narrative that formed in those notebooks was disconcerting, for though it was broadcast across the country, it remained strangely silent inside homes. The Congolese didn't vocally acknowledge it. They didn't transmit or hand it down. They listened, quietly assimilated it, and returned to their rituals.
Riz Ahmed continues to read Stringer by Anjan Sundaram at the same time tomorrow. It's arranged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Elizabeth Allard.
Over 50 years ago, Leonard Bernstein's take on Romeo and Juliet exploded onto the American stage.
By using that tritone right away, you set up this conflict that requires some sort of resolution.
BBC Radio 4 unearths the original score of West Side Story.
It's clear from letters he writes to his wife that the collaborators were constantly telling him, you're being too operatic, you're being too large.
The new series of Tales from the Stage.
It's all about body language and setting up this is actually going to be a gang ballet. Who ever heard of something like that?
This morning at 11:30.
And then at midday, Call You and Yours wants to hear your experience of the property market and getting a mortgage. The lines are open now, 03 700 100 444. That's 03 700 100 444.